and proceed to case number six, please. United States versus Detron Bonner.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Susan Kister, appearing for the defendants in this case. I'd like to discuss very briefly or revisit the evidence in this case because it's within the context of the evidence which was before the jury that the government took numerous opportunities to inform the jury that the defendant in this case not only was probably a shady character and a bad guy, but also had a record and had been convicted of a crime. And those are the complaints which we address in the brief. As the court knows, Mr. Bonner was charged with maintaining a crack house. And there was evidence to show that he had some connection with this property. We know that he had keys to the property. He was there when the home was raided at the time of his arrest and his co-defendant's arrest. The other thing we know is that there was a piece of mail within the house addressed to him. The record does not show any date on that piece of mail. I don't know if it was postmarked. We do know it was from a collection agency, which means that it could have arrived at any time. It could have been, you know, coming to that from the collection agency for the last 10 months looking for money. That's all we know about that piece of mail. So there's some connection between the defendant in this case and the property, but he's charged with maintaining a crack house, which meant that the government had to prove more than just a connection to the property. It had to prove that he had knowledge that dope was being sold there. And we don't know much about that. The evidence on that was very slim. In fact, the only evidence to show his knowledge of what was going on within this very small window of a two-month framework comes from one informant who says that he bought crack from Mr. Bonner on one occasion. That's uncorroborated. No surveilling officer sees Mr. Bonner coming and going either on that one occasion or on any other of the five occasions when there's a sale transacted within those premises. So we don't know much about Mr. Bonner's knowledge of the goings-on within that property. And it's within this context that the jury is informed, number one, that he's got a record, and that comes in through his probation officer. And
but if he's maintaining that he doesn't live there, merely babysits there occasionally, why wasn't it appropriate for the government to establish through the probation officer that he listed that address as his residence?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, he doesn't establish that until his case. Now, the record does indicate that defense counsel argues that, or at least presumes that to be a defense in opening remarks, but that doesn't give the government the opportunity then in its case in chief to establish that residency unless and until, in fact, there's evidence put on in the defense case that the defendant was merely a bystander or a babysitter and, you know, was there on occasion just, you know, in that capacity. Now, I submit that once that evidence did come in, and it does come in through a family member in the defense case, the government is free at that point to rebut it and possibly to bring on the probation officer. But even then, I would suggest that when it's a probation officer, the court has to look at that with a very careful eye. I mean, this is a person with authority, with stature, and clearly what you're informing the jury of just with her presence there on the stand is that he's got a record. He's been convicted of something. And although it's sanitized and the jury is not informed as to what he's been convicted of, they're aware of the fact that he's been convicted of something. And unfortunately, that error, in my judgment, is compounded by the fact that Taran Harris is then called to say basically the same thing and oversteps the court's ruling in that regard, and not only testifies that he recognized the guy who had been, or on one occasion, arguably had sold him drugs inside of that house, but that he was there meeting with a probation officer, conducting business, which clearly was outside of the scope of the court's ruling and, again, prejudiced him. And I would submit that, those two pieces of evidence in the face of very slim evidence as to knowledge was prejudicial, and that the court erred in its discretion in allowing those pieces of evidence before the jury.
All right, thank you. Counsel.
May it please the court. The district court did not abuse its discretion in this case in making any of the evidentiary decisions that were challenged by the defendant, and the defendant's conviction, therefore, should not be set aside. First, the court did not err in admitting testimony from the defendant's probation officer that he had informed her on seven prior occasions between January and April of 2001 that he resided at 5154 Tennessee Street, the crack house alleged in this case.
I can see that, but tell me this. In what respect was the confidential informant's testimony that he saw Mr. Bonner meeting with his probation officer probative of any relevant aspect of this case?
Your Honor, that evidence was introduced, and it was conceded by defense counsel at trial to be introduced as an identification, not a court identification at that point. The circumstances of that was that on February 12th, Tyrann Harris, the confidential informant, had gone and had made a controlled buy. The next day, as was testified to, he went to his probation officer, met his probation officer at the Gary City Courts building, and immediately made a phone call to, I believe it was James Parcell, to one of the other officers who was on the GRIT task force, and said, "I saw one of the people who I've been dealing with at 5154 Tennessee Street at the building at that time." And therefore, it was an identification that he made. He then said in his testimony, "And the person that I saw on that day was the defendant in this case, who's sitting right over there at counsel table." So it was part of an identification. That was the purpose for which the testimony was gotten into at all. Now, what happened in that particular instance was that the district court said, "You can make the identification, but I don't want any reference made to the fact that the person he was meeting with was his probation officer or any of that." The question came out at trial, and in response to a fairly non-leading question, he responded, "You know, well, what was he doing there? What did you observe Mr. Bonner to be doing?" And he responded, "Seems he was talking to his probation officer." There was no objection from the defense counsel at that point.
Who gave that answer?
Mr. Harris did, who was on the witness stand. And at that point, I think defense counsel, if it wished to make an objection, had the obligation to stand up to object, to say this is outside of the order that was entered by the court. And in that case, a limiting instruction could have been given, something could have been dealt with on that matter. Since no objection was raised, I think that the precedent from this court makes clear that the standard is harmless error. And under a harmless error standard, I don't believe that the defendant can prevail before this court if we're looking at harmless error on that matter. The statement was really just cumulative. The jury had in front of it the witness, Ms. Montgomery's report from February 13, 2001 on that evidence, on the first part of what the defendant is challenging, in which she had written 5154 Tennessee Street, "I am here," and reflecting that he was meeting with his probation officer. So certainly the fact that Mr. Harris later did make that brief statement in passing called attention to that fact, but it doesn't rise to the level that he would probably have been acquitted in this case if that single statement had been kept out. And without an objection, that is the standard here in this case. Going back to the first part of the issue as to whether the probation officer's statements and whether those records are relevant at all, I believe that it's clear that they are relevant. The case law shows that residence is a relevant factor that can be relied upon in determining whether a person has maintained a crack house and has knowledge that this place that is a crack house is a place that they are maintaining as a crack house. And under those circumstances, I don't think, as defense counsel has alleged, that we have to wait until defense counsel actually puts on a witness who says this person didn't reside at this house. He made the statements clearly in his opening argument. And this cross-examination of the police officers who testified before Ms. Montgomery took the stand was to the effect of, you never saw the defendant at the house at that time. You never saw him making any of these buys. You never saw him in any of your videotapes. The clear thrust of the defense case was that the defendant didn't reside there, that he did happen to be there on the occasion of the arrest and of the search warrant, but that he wasn't there beforehand. And so this was clear probative evidence of the fact that he did, in fact, reside at that location. He had told his probation officer on 7 occasions in the 4 months leading up to the time and during the entire time in which the controlled buys into the house were taking place that he did reside there. And so it's clear that it is probative evidence, and the district court then made a balancing analysis and did not abuse its discretion in making that analysis. Found that it did not want to have got into at all any of the information about what the crime was, how long the defendant had been on probation, other than during the limited time period in which we knew that this was a crack house and we knew that controlled buys were going in, and that outside of that limited information, that would not be got into, and that the prejudice would therefore be limited as much as possible. But I think this was extremely probative evidence. It was the best evidence that the government had that he did reside at the house and he did know what was going on and he was present at the buys. Just to clear up one brief statement that the appellant's counsel made in this case, the evidence from Mr. Harris at trial was that of the 5 specific controlled buys that he made into the house, only one of them was to the defendant, Mr. Bonner. But he also testified that he had made numerous previous buys into the house and that Mr. Bonner, the man he knew as Tony, had been present at those buys. And in fact, that loops right back to Judge Rovner's question again. He made the identification before the buy, the March 5th buy that he said he had made to Tony. He told them beforehand, I made a lot of buys and this is the guy who was at the house. And that's, again, shows there was a little more evidence, but the strongest evidence that he maintained this house and that he resided at this house was that evidence from the probation officer's testimony. The final issue presented in this case, defense counsel didn't raise in her argument, but I would just briefly state that the prior confession to the police officer to renting a car in exchange for 2 dime bags of crack cocaine was a reliable statement and was properly admitted under Rule 404B. I think the only part in her brief that she really is challenging is the reliability of the statement. Under Huddleston, and as has been clear since 1988, the standard there is only that there need to be sufficient evidence to support a jury finding that the defendant committed the act, and here the defendant's own confession to committing the act, I believe, is sufficiently reliable. We've taken statements from co-conspirators about other information, and this court has upheld those as reliable. And under the circumstances, I think the same would apply here.
Right.
If there are no further questions, the United States would ask that the defendant's conviction in this case be affirmed.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have anything to add, please? Shirley.
Your Honor, while it may be correct and is correct that defense counsel did not in this case object after Tyran Harris went beyond the scope of the pretrial ruling and stated not only that he recognized this guy Tony, but also Tony was meeting with his probation officer. There was no objection interposed at this point, but I submit that that's not a minor point in this case. Defense counsel bent over backwards in pretrial proceedings to circumvent the testimony that was going to come in from Mr. Harris. And, you know, there was considerable colloquy by the court limiting what Mr. Harris was going to say, admonishments to the prosecutor, limit him, lead him, and when the prosecutor asks that last question, which is not necessarily a leading question, but is going, you know, it's susceptible of a certain response, what did you see him doing? Not only establishing identification, but what did you see him doing while he was there? The question was not only unnecessary, but was bound to provoke the response that it did, which was while he was meeting with his probation officer. That's no small potatoes, I think, in light of the rest of the case. One other quick point, while residency may be probative of the charge in this case, I would submit, oh, I've lost my train of thought on this. I'll go to my third point very quickly. While Mr. Harris did indicate to the GRIT officers at the inception of the investigation that he had bought on possibly several occasions from this guy Tony within the house, I would submit that this wasn't great evidence either of the defendant's knowledge in this case. Had the government itself thought that there was evidence here that Mr. Bonner was selling on repeated occasions to Mr. Harris, I would submit that they would have charged him with sales. They didn't charge him with sales. They charged him with maintaining a residence, which I think was a last-ditch effort. It was the best that they had. And then to buttress that, which was weak in itself, they brought on evidence that, which I believe should have been excluded. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You're welcome. Court will take the case under advisement. Court will adjourn until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m. Thank you all very much. You take yourself.